Good morning, everybody. This is Jonathan Kirk from SUNY Downstate, and today I have the privilege of talking with Dr. Catherine Mortati, who's the director of the EEG lab and the EMU, the Epilepsy Monitoring Unit, in the Division of Epilepsy here at SUNY Downstate Medical Center. So, Catherine, thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
And so, in PEPS, I think what we would like to do today is to focus on status epilepticus, the recent new definition. So I think there's lots to talk about. So how about, let's start with how would you define status epilepticus?
That's almost the hardest question, because I think it's still formal definition, as far as I'm aware, is still the one that was sort of made in 1970 and revised in 1981 or something by the ILAE, which is the International League Against Epilepsy. And they sort of guide our understanding of nomenclature, classification, definition. And this is a definition that everybody listening to this is probably comfortable with, which is the idea of 30 minutes of continuous seizure activity or two seizures spanning that time, in between which, two discrete seizures, in between which there isn't complete recovery and return to normal function. There is, interestingly, well, probably over the last 20 years, there's been a movement that 30 minutes isn't right. 30 minutes is really reflects the time that neuronal injury and death can set in, and that the horse is out of the barn if we're not treating before that. And so there's been this idea of an operational definition being either 5 to 10 minutes. This was Dr. Grant's disagreement with me, that the definition today is 5 to 10 minutes. I think all of us understand that we need to start treating at 5 to 10 minutes, and there's several reasons for that. When we're looking at convulsive seizures, but this is really true for partial seizures as well, whether they secondarily generalize or not, but in particular, convulsive seizures rarely last more than 2 minutes. So when you have a seizure going on 4 minutes, let alone 5 minutes, that's an abnormally prolonged seizure. While you may not intervene at 2 minutes, you have to start thinking about it once the seizure is lasting longer than that. Another reason is that we know from several studies that the people who are treated earlier do better. Response to initial treatments, such as benzodiazepines, is better earlier than if the seizure has gone on for a long time. The other thing is, practically speaking, it can take 5 to 10 minutes to prepare these IV, IM formulations that you're going to need to administer. So there's been a lot of push for the last almost 2 decades to change this 30-minute concept. This podcast is really timely because two weeks ago, a new ILE task force came out with a proposed definition. When we talk about board questions, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, this year, I would say 30 minutes is probably the right thing to answer. Next year, I think that might change. So the current proposed definition from this new task force that came out 2 weeks ago is, and forgive me, I'm just going to read this. This is quite wordy. Status epilepticus is a condition resulting either from the failure of mechanisms responsible for seizure termination or from the initiation of mechanisms which lead to abnormally prolonged seizures after time point T1. It's a condition which can have long-term consequences after time point T2, including neuronal death, neuronal injury, and alteration of neuronal networks, depending on the type and duration of seizures. So why is T1 and T2? Well, we know, and we're going to get to this next, that there are different kinds of status. And mostly during this discussion, we're going to be focused on generalized convulsive status, or convulsive status that evolves into non-convulsive status, but that began convulsive. So this idea of time point T1 is that we really want to know at what point a seizure is abnormally prolonged. And for generalized convulsive status, they've gone with this 5-minute definition, as I'm sure many of us hoped they would. Time point T2 is the time at which we believe that long-term consequences can occur. With animal experiments, and unfortunately even with some human data, we know very well with generalized convulsive status that this is 30 minutes. So essentially now, hopefully we're going to be looking at generalized convulsive status as 5 minutes. But you have to understand that you're not going to necessarily see status epilepticus within the 5 minutes because there are different kinds. So they're proposing that absence status, it really is 10 minutes where it's abnormally prolonged. And I don't think that would shock a lot of the pediatric epileptologists as they see children who have absence seizures for up to 7 or 8 minutes and then they abort spontaneously. That's unusual, but sometimes you don't have to interfere. As for focal status, or what was originally considered complex partial status, again, proposing different numbers, that 10 minutes is a time at which point you should consider the seizure abnormally prolonged and you should act. The problem with that, just like with absence status, is we don't quite have enough data. And that really goes, maybe segues nicely into types. So many years ago, Gaston proposed that there are as many types of status as there are seizures. I think that we all believe that's still true, and we would think of status as generalized convulsive status, either coming from primary generalized seizures or focal seizures or secondarily generalized, but where the person's in the ED, they're seen by the ED resident or the neuro resident as shaking all over, in coma, or without awareness. And then there's absence status, which is much, much more mild, much less severe, much less dangerous. And then many things in between. What we would have called complex partial status, whether it's from temporal origin or frontal origin, simple partial status, the difference in the two being that with complex partial status, there's impairment of awareness. Whereas with simple partial status, you may have a subset called epilepsia partialis continua, which is continuous focal motor status of a certain portion of the body, just the left arm, for example, just the left hand, for example, but the person's wide awake. Then you can have a simple sensory status where somebody has continuous numbness of the right leg. You can have autonomic status. So many, many different kinds. Think about childhood epilepsies, even more kinds. Febrile status epilepticus. Landau-Kleffner is sort of thought to be this acquired epileptic aphasia or prolonged epileptic aphasic status. The same task force that has proposed a new definition of status is also proposing a new classification of the types of status. The reason is really based on prognosis and treatment. And let's look at, instead of just generalized convulsive status, absence status, non-convulsive status, let's look at what are the differences in the kinds of status, how serious they are, maybe what the potential morbidity and mortality are, and just as in the definition with those time points T1 and T2, how do you treat them and how do you treat them differently? So the new definition, this task force has now looking at, well, let's look at semiology. Let's look at whether or not there are motor symptoms and whether or not there is impaired awareness. And depending on the presence or absence of these, there still will be many subsets. I'm not going to get more into that because I think that we're not yet sure really how this is going to pan out and what this means for our understanding of status. So more to come on that.
So I guess as a resident, when you talk about those definitions of times, I think that the important thing, I think the message is that it's a medical emergency, that time plays a crucial factor and we have to think in advance, and also that maybe most of the time we tend to think about a certain type of status that we will need in the emergency room, but there are actually more than one type out there. It's not only the generalized.
Absolutely, and thank you for maybe bringing me back to the point here, which is that really what I think the focus of today's podcast should be is generalized convulsive, or let's just say convulsive status epilepticus, which may evolve into non-convulsive status epilepticus. So if we think about past kinds of our current understanding, maybe not this new proposed definition, but our current understanding of status is that this generalized convulsive type is the most emergent and the most dangerous. It's been thought of as the most common. I think as we get to epidemiology, we'll see that it may be the most common because it's the one we recognize the most, because it these patients come into the ER with convulsive activity. Whereas somebody else comes in with altered mental status, they're not going to get earmarked as non-convulsive complex partial status. So of course then there's also non-convulsive status, which is, can be absence status or complex partial status, or even some people use the term, use it a little bit incorrectly, to be a convulsive status which has lost its motor component, which happens over time. These types that we're talking about, if you think about generalized convulsive status, it is characterized by profound coma. Initially, with this progression of clinical activity from overt convulsive activity to more subtle twitches of the extremities and trunk, potentially to losing some of those subtle twitches of the extremity and trunk and just seeing some nystagmoid movement or some mild facial twitching, to a total absence of motor activity. So somebody with a total absence of motor activity who maybe hasn't been treated with the status protocol yet, but can have begun with generalized convulsive activity. And then, as I said, there are the non-convulsive types and the simple partial types, and we know a lot less about those and about the correct treatment and prognosis of those.
So how about, let's talk about the some of the etiologies and maybe the pathophysiology.
You guys are mostly going to be seeing generalized convulsive status either with overt convulsive activity, or it has progressed by the time you get there, more subtle activity, or you'll see somebody with no activity and a profound coma, because by the time the neuro residents are there, the ED residents and faculty have already done their thing and they've already been, treatment has already begun. Epidemiology of this, the numbers are range, really. I always love this. Anywhere from 10 to 40 is felt to be the annual incidence per 100,000 patients. The interesting thing is that if you separate out epidemiology by age, you see that status, generalized convulsive status, is far more common in extremes of life. Less than 1 year old, greater than 65 years old. So the annual incidence in infants is, that number skyrockets from 10 to 40 to 140 to 160. And in the elderly, it's also quite elevated, anywhere from 60 to 90. The reason for that, Jonathan, really is, as you mentioned, because of etiology. And status isn't really a disease in and of itself. Status is a symptom. Status is an exacerbation related to some underlying disease. And what are these diseases? Well, in the elderly, stroke is the leading cause. Probably 50% of cases of status in the elderly are because of stroke. Tumor is also a big one in the elderly. Other neurodegenerative problems. In children, infection with fever, febrile status, really comes about, and that's another 50% of their cases. When you look across the board at all ages, the interesting thing is the number one cause is discontinuation of AEDs, anti-epileptic drugs, in patients who have epilepsy. That's probably the number one cause for patients between maybe 15 and 50 or 15 and 60, even though those aren't, even though the incidence in the elderly and the very young is even higher and related to those other etiologies. But if you look all across the board, etiologies, number one is discontinuation of anti-epileptic drugs. Number two is stroke. Number three is alcohol withdrawal. Then, of course, there's idiopathic and anoxia, metabolic problems, hemorrhage, infection, tumor, trauma, drugs, and the list goes on. But the top ones you really have to think of are going to be discontinued. If you see a middle-aged person, you always have to wonder, do they have epilepsy? Are they on medications at home? The ER likely will have already drawn levels for Dilantin, Depakote, Carbamazepine. And maybe you'll have them back by the time you get there. And just because they're zero doesn't mean that they shouldn't be something. And then in your older patients, again, stroke, and in your younger patients, more febrile illness. Again, when you look, another way of looking at etiology, when you look across the board at all ages, is a third of cases of status are really a complication of chronic epilepsy. Just the way maybe asthma attack in a large percentage of patients is a complication of having asthma. But about a third of the cases are new, and it's an indication of new onset epilepsy. Another third of the case, I'm sorry, I should say two-thirds of the cases are new. One-third is an indication of new onset epilepsy, and another third is a complication of any of these other things, infectious process, new stroke, tumor, something like that. Why status develops, I think, by and large, is still a mystery. Despite a lot of efforts and work, I think that the mechanisms for which a seizure becomes abnormally prolonged and the brain's typical mechanisms to abort a seizure fail are unknown. There's a lot of proposed mechanisms. I'm not sure it's worth talking about them because in the end, we don't know. One interesting finding that does seem to really pan out, and this will return again when we start talking about treatment and ideal treatment, is that in all of these studies, one thing that consistently, or has been seen, I shouldn't say consistently, is that something happens with the GABA-A receptor. And there's something with the subunit that benzos connect to, that there's a receptor subunit internalization so that these cells, the neurons are losing sensitivity to benzodiazepines, which when you think about it and you think about people who are treated really early with a benzo, their seizures stop much more easily than if somebody is treated 15, 20 minutes later with a benzo. We see that, we can talk about that in a little bit, and that's at least one fact in one part of the pathophysiology that is known. But that doesn't really explain why status starts. Mm-hmm. It certainly can help explain, maybe not so much why it ends, but why it doesn't stop, but why it's so hard to treat as time goes on. So how do we diagnose status? Well, as a neurology resident, very often you're called down and told somebody's in status, they've been seizing for X amount of time. Let's say you're doing your ED rotation. When you have somebody coming through on a gurney having bilateral convulsive activity, that's pretty much your diagnosis. In rare cases, we'll be wrong because there's such a thing as psychogenic non-epileptic status. But by and large, at least for generalized convulsive status in its early stages, you see it. Your eyes are your diagnosis. As time progresses, and with other forms of status, EEG really becomes necessary. And so your suspicion is really important. Why is this person having this altered mental status? Why is this person having these nystagmoid movements of their eyes? Unfortunately, EEG is really important. Fortunately, and I'm not, you know, advertising this, although it will be happening, we are going to be having EEG available in ED soon. And so many of these cases that residents always ask us, well, what should I do and how do I know? And we as epileptologists are really spoiled because we come in the scene when the EEG's there. And I know we're really spoiled. And a little bit far, we're always far from the initiation of status. Hopefully EEG will now be available much sooner to help diagnose these patients so that they can get more prompt treatment.
So let's say we are called to see the patient, we understand it's an emergency, we think we diagnosed it, it is status epilepticus. So what is our treatment goal and what are the treatments?
Well, if we're talking about somebody who, let's imagine the overt convulsive activity is gone, I'm going to go back to diagnosis just for a second. And you're wondering, because EEG isn't available to you yet, so it should be soon, but it isn't yet. And you come down and maybe there isn't profound coma, but there's severely impaired awareness and the patients aren't following commands and they're fairly obtunded. Then I think that for sure, if EMT, family member or friend witnessed convulsive activity, then you're going to assume that that's still status. If you have somebody who's maybe waking up or conversing, then maybe there is status if they fall back into another seizure, but when we're looking at the goals of treatment, obviously the first thing you have to figure out is how severe you think this illness is. And obviously that's where EEG is going to be very helpful, but your clinical exam and how impaired the patient is, and the history is really going to dictate your next course. So in terms of the dangerous generalized status, your goal is to stop that seizure, to stop that status as soon as possible. We know that the longer the seizure duration, the higher the mortality, the harder it is to stop the seizure, the more drug it takes to stop the seizure, the less effective those drugs at even higher doses are. If you have a patient who very clearly tells you they have a history of absence epilepsy and, you know, they're losing hours of the day and are really out of it, then your treatment goal is going to be similar, stop the seizure, but not as dire. So how severe the patient really determines the aggression of your treatment. Although in all cases of status, your goal is to stop seizures. Your goal is to stop seizures in every case. The timeline and the treatment may vary. The degree of medical aggressivity is going to vary.
So what are the principles of the stepwise aggressive treatment?
Well, the things that a neurologist should know, and you know, we created this protocol that you can go and look at and really should look at and become familiar with, and it should become rote just the way a stroke protocol should become rote for you. The main things to think about is a benzodiazepine has to get in there right away. It should be prompt. It should have been started in the field. And one thing I'm not sure why it hasn't happened is we don't see as aggressive treatment as in the field as perhaps we should. But you have to make sure that they've gotten either lorazepam or diazepam at the maximal dose if you still see them seizing. If they're still seizing and they haven't gotten the maximal dose of a benzo, you have to make sure that they do. We prefer lorazepam. There's studies that show us that there probably is lorazepam superiority over diazepam. I think you all will see that very commonly an ambulance will have gotten diazepam. When you're in the ER and they've gotten no lorazepam and they're still seizing, you have to look at their body weight and they get 0.1 milligrams per kilogram. They don't get 2 milligrams of Ativan and then they're still seizing 5 minutes later, 2 more milligrams of Ativan. You look at 0.1 milligrams per kilogram in a 70 kilogram person, you're going to be giving them 7 milligrams at 2 milligrams per minute. You can do it in two boluses. You can do the first bolus of 4 milligrams, the second bolus of 3 milligrams within a few minutes. What we see a lot, although I'm hoping this is changing, you see a lot that somebody's giving 2 milligrams, and then another 2 milligrams, and then another 2 milligrams, and then they stop. And if the person is 60 kgs, perfect. But if they're not, that's really not perfect. And with our population, I think most of them aren't. So you have to give the full dose. That is the number one treatment. It should be prompt. You know, none of us is really going to be there by 5 minutes, but hopefully it will have started somewhere by 5 minutes. Fortunately, some of these medications are more available to patients to even begin some sort of benzo at home under the tongue clonopin, as these clonopin wafers. For children, obviously, there's Diastat. There probably are midazolam nasal sprays coming out to allow witnesses and caregivers and family members to start treating right away. But that's number one. Make sure they get the full dose of benzo. They continue to see, they wake up, you're done. You're not walking away. You're watching them, and you're making sure, at least you're done with emergent treatment, I should say. And then you're going to make sure that they're on whatever anti-epileptic they should be on, and if they're not, that you start something. They're still seizing within 15, 20 minutes, but really at least at the 15-minute point. You're starting fosphenytoin or phenytoin IV, 20 milligrams per kilogram, and make sure they get 20 milligrams per kilogram, not 1 gram Dilantin, which we hear so much. But look at, are they 60 or 70 kgs? Then they should be getting 1.2 or 1.4 milligrams, grams, excuse me. Within another 10 to 20 minutes, if seizing continues, you're allowed to give another 10. And then within the next hour or so, if seizing continues, for sure you'll probably be calling the NICU, and you'll be loading with Phenobarb. So number one drug is benzo, and it's got to be quick, and it's got to be at maximal doses. You don't have to push all 8 milligrams if they're 80 milligram, if they're 80 kg in weight right away, but you have to get that 8 milligrams in within about 10 minutes. Second is fosphenytoin or phenytoin, and then third is going to be phenobarbital. After that, and phenobarbital is going to come along with anesthesia and intubation. After that, you're going to be considering one of the IV sedatives of midazolam or pentobarb or propofol. And there's reasons to consider any one of the three that are determined really by the patient and sometimes by what's present in the pharmacy. For some of these other cases, or if you imagine that after the phosphenytoin, the twitching has stopped, the patient's in a profound coma, and there are no nystagmus movements, and deep stimulation causes no response. You don't see spontaneous movements. What is that? Well, you don't know. It may still be status, and it may be that they've gotten snowed with benzodiazepines and the status has stopped. I think that until the moment that EEG is available, you have to assume that it's still status, because the risk for prolonged untreated status is much higher than the risk than the iatrogenic risk of treating somebody perhaps with phenobarb and intubating them when the status has stopped.
So I guess we focused on the status itself, and obviously meanwhile treating, we send all the lab tests and in the emergency room many times they would do that for you. And I guess monitoring of the heart and the blood pressure and all the good stuff that has been
Everything else that I skipped over, that's equally important.
Going back to the seizures, and so as I understand, the goal is to stop the seizures, and obviously there are definite etiology, and that probably determines also the rest of the steps. But what in general are the next steps in the NICU, and maybe it's tied to prognosis after?
Great question, Jonathan. So let's say you're 6 hours later and it's Monday to Friday in the middle of the day and you were lucky enough to get an EEG right away and they're still in status. It's electrical status epilepticus. There's no clinical movement, and you now have put the person on midazolam drip. As you're titrating that drip, you're going to continue to stop the status, try and treat the status. Once you get to midazolam, pentobarb, propofol, your goal is going to be, with the help of the epilepsy fellow, the epilepsy team, to titrate to burst suppression, a typical pattern in EEG. When we get there, we like to stay there for 1 or 2 days, depending on how hard it was to get there. If it was pretty easy to get there, it only took a little bit of Versed, it happened really quickly within 4 or 5 hours of the patient coming into the ER and getting treated, then probably by the next morning the NICU is going to start to wean, and that's reasonable. But as you're doing that, you need to be asking, why did this happen? What did the CT show if they got a CT? Or make sure they get it if you don't know that this is a patient with chronic epilepsy, or this is a patient who has a new right frontal lesion because the wife is standing right there telling you that. When you don't know why, as you're treating to burst suppression, your first thing is to maximize your treatment. Get them to burst suppression. When you're there, why did it happen? All along you should be asking why. Because that may play a role in how difficult it is to get to burst suppression. So in the back of your mind is always why, if you don't know the answer. Oh, this is my patient and, you know, she came in with GI illness and has been having vomiting and diarrhea, and it's not even that she wasn't taking her medicines, it's just malabsorption and vomiting in the mouth. Then you have your reason. But once it's difficult, look, you have to look for the cause. In particular, in a patient in whom it's difficult to get to burst suppression, even if you think you know the cause, you should be looking for other things and thinking about other things. Because the etiology of the status is really the most important factor in determining prognosis. As we've been talking about this for the last while, the duration of the seizure is a really important factor. But the etiology is probably even more so. Unless you leave somebody seizing for 2 hours and don't intervene, then morbidity and mortality is going to skyrocket. But as long as you take the appropriate steps, etiology is really important. Is this somebody who is in alcohol withdrawal? Is this somebody who just had a stroke? So you have to be looking for the cause. And a lot of times once you, and this is not a criticism, this is an observation. Once you have somebody whose lab work doesn't show anything, who's hemodynamically stable, and you've gotten them into burst suppression, if you don't know the cause, the MICU is not going to be as aggressive as we would like them to be. Or I don't see that happening. I see that neurology really has to look into that. So I can't really, I know I've said it 10 times, but it's because I can't emphasize enough that the etiology is so tied to the prognosis. As we look at prognosis, and we discussed the length of the seizure, let me give you a couple numbers that came out of some of these important studies. They define subtle status epilepticus compared to overt status epilepticus. We're talking about convulsive status. Overt status is overt. Convulsive status, you can see bilateral convulsive activities of the extremities. Subtle status is as overt status has become subtle. It's gone on long enough that the convulsive activity, the convulsive component has really died down. And you're just going to see twitches here and there, little nystagmoid seizures, little nystagmoid movements, excuse me. What we saw in a VA study from 20 years ago now was that 65% of those in subtle status died within 30 days of the episode of status, compared to 27% of those in overt status. So this really speaks to duration and the timing of your beginning treatment. Prognosis is also related to age. The elderly do much worse, probably for many other reasons, perhaps because of the high incidence of stroke in these cases, and because of their other medical problems. If you separate out children and adults, the mortality in children is 3%. The mortality in status in children is 3% compared to 26% in adults. And when you look at adults, the mortality skyrockets with age, above 60 or so. And then finally, the last thing is etiology. So if somebody has an anoxic status or hypoxic status or other cerebrovascular status, they have much worse outcomes. Compared to patients who didn't take their medicines or had malabsorption due to GI illness or even rarely status related to Alzheimer's or something. It's really the cerebrovascular problems and hypoxic problems that have those causes that have the greatest mortality and morbidity.
Well, this is a fantastic overview. Thank you so much for this. So what are some of the take-home points that you would like maybe our neurology residents to carry in their tool bag?
I think there are a few things. I think that number one, in terms of treating patients, not in terms of the answer to the boards, in terms of treating patients, somebody who's seizing, convulsive seizing at 5 minutes needs to be treated right then, needs to start. Any seizure lasting more than 2 minutes is unusual. At 5 minutes, we're going to consider it status. We all do. We're not allowed to write that as a formal definition, except maybe soon. But so 5 minutes of continuous seizure activity, and we're talking about bilateral convulsive activity, not somebody who is confused and you know that these confusion episodes have been seizures, because you really need EEG for that, and the treatment of focal status is much more controversial and we still don't really know exactly how aggressive to be. So treatment should be prompt and aggressive. While I didn't mention this, ABCs first. Usually there's somebody else there managing that and you're there to guide with the medical management in terms of anti-epileptic medications. We prefer lorazepam to diazepam, and it's a 0.1 mg per kg dose, so just get that into your head. You can give it at a rate of 2 milligrams per minute, and you should make sure to give all of it within about 10 minutes of starting treatment. Next line of treatment, patient is still seizing within another 10 minutes or so, or at minute 15 to 20, you should have already asked for your fosphenytoin drip. You can always send it back. So you should ask for it right away, so that it's going to take a little while for them to prepare it. Fosphenytoin or phenytoin at 20 mg per kg, not 1 gram, just no matter what the size, 20 mg per kg. And within another 10 minutes, you can repeat another 10 milligrams. There's no reason not to. You're not going to worsen the status by giving them a level, dilantin level of 33. You could worsen it by giving them a dilantin level of 55, but you're not going to get there with the 20 mg per kg plus 10 mg per kg. After that, you really need to continue treating to stop any clinical seizure activity. Your next drug is going to be phenobarbital, and at that point, ICU is probably already going to be called, and you're going to be thinking about midazolam, propofol, pentobar. Other take-home point is that I think really importantly, as I'm saying, keep treating when you see this bilateral convulsive activity. Be suspicious when you no longer see bilateral convulsive activity, but the person's not waking up. Be suspicious that that's still seizure. And until we have the EEG and the ED available for you, when there's profound coma, lack of responsiveness to deep stimulation, lack of some spontaneous movement or activity, even if the heart rate is stable, probably it's better for the patient for you to assume they're in electrical status and continue treating with anesthetics, intubation, midazolam, than to say, oh, they're not seizing anymore, they're just postictal and post all these drugs. Hopefully you're not going to have to call for video EEG, because hopefully the EEG is going to be right there, and then we're going to arrange video EEG. But for sure, if it looks like status is gone, but the person's unresponsive, you need your EEG. And then finally, you have to look for the cause. It should be in the back of your mind, or on the side of your mind, I guess, concomitantly with your treatment measures. But you have to keep looking.
Well, that's a fantastic overview. Thank you very much.
My again, pleasure.
Dr. Catherine Mortati, the director of the EEG lab and EMU here at SUNY Downstate Medical Center. And this is Jonathan
Thanks, Kirk. Jonathan.
Until next time, thank you very much.